The Bite Show is listener supported at thebiteshow.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we are really blessed to have Joseph P. Farrell with us. And Joseph's website is GizaDeathStar.com. There is a PayPal button. Go there, make a donation. We need to keep Joseph in research material. And tonight we're going to change the pace a little bit. Joseph's newest book, LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, A Coalescence of Interests. Joseph, what prompted you to write this book?
Hi, Georgianne. Thanks for having me back. Well, it's really an interesting question because I had always been interested in the Kennedy assassination because I, you know, like many Americans, I was alive at the time it happened.
Yeah.
In fact, I was a little boy, you know, 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I was home from school that Friday. So in other words, I actually watched it happen. You know, as it was being broadcast on CBS News, I remember them interrupting Mom's soap opera,
yeah.
which was, I even remember it. It was As the World Turns, you know, and,
yeah.
and they interrupted the soap opera, and the story began to unfold. And then later, they got the remote broadcast set up in Dallas, and you know, it affected everybody that was alive at the time.
Yes.
But, you know, to a boy, it sat with me all those years, and I've read a great deal about it since then. But I had intended to write a book about the Kennedy assassination at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But then my publisher, David Childress from Adventures Unlimited, contacted me last summer and asked me if I would be willing to do a book that another author had been contracted to do, but for whatever reason had to back out.
Yes.
And I asked him what the book was supposed to be about, and he told me, and I said, well, if you'll let me do this my way, you know, I'll do it. So it was actually kind of a bit of prodding on my publisher's part that made me do this book. So it's I did the book kind of out of sequence from where I had intended to cover the Kennedy assassination, which would have been a couple of years from now.
Yeah.
But I had intended to eventually at some point. But it's okay, you know. it all worked out.
Well, what do you mean by a coalescence of interest?
Well, another good question. I've spent probably ever since that time as a boy, I have tried to read as much as I can about it. And the first thing that struck me is a year later, when I was 7 years old, the Warren Report was finally issued by President Johnson. And it was excerpted. If you were alive at the time, and you remember that newspapers around the country excerpted portions of it.
Yes.
And some of them even published that diagram from the Warren Report of the magic bullet doing its somersaulting gymnastics act, you know,
yes.
to pull off what needed to be pulled off in order to make Oswald the lone assassin firing with an inaccurate Italian Mannlicher Carcano on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository with a misaligned telescopic sight through a Texas live oak tree.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
So, you know, as a boy of seven, you know that bullets just don't do this sort of thing. You know?
Yes.
So I had read everything since that time that I can get my hands on the Kennedy assassination, and most of the major authors that have published in the field, David Lifton and Robert Groden, and you know, all those people. I've read them all, Jim Mars. And what struck me, George Ann, is that every one of those assassination researchers, including the ones implicating Lyndon Johnson himself at some level in the conspiracy, mm-hmm. every one of them, on the basis of the evidence printed in the Warren Commission's indexed volumes,
yes.
made a plausible and arguable case that their group or collection of individuals was somehow involved. In other words, there have been books out about the mafia angle to it. There have been books out about the CIA and the intelligence and military-industrial complex angle to it. There have been books covering the angle of the anti-Castro Cubans as possible involved players, and on the list goes, all right? And what struck me is they're all making plausible arguments, but what they're not getting is the fact that this is a much, much bigger picture than even they themselves have argued, that we may be looking at something that was exactly what Jack Ruby himself said, and that is that the conspiracy was so large that people really wouldn't believe how large it really was.
Yes.
in terms of all of the implicated interests and groups behind it. You know, there have been other books about the involvement of the Texas oil men, the Texas oil tycoons. There have been books involved about just every imaginable permutation that you can think of. And in reading all these books over the years, I came to the conclusion that what we were looking at was not a conspiracy in the standard sense. What we were looking at was a conspiracy that was connected to or representative of the deep parapolitical power structures that actually do run the country.
Oh.
And that Kennedy himself was threatening those power structures to, in other words, to close down the power and influence of the hidden government, so to speak. Well, again, it's that coalescence of interests. In other words, if we look at all the groups that have been fingered, you know, just let me enumerate them and you'll see what I mean. We have the mafia, we have the intelligence community, represented largely by the CIA and the FBI.
Yeah.
We have the military-industrial complex, we have the Texas oil barons, we have the bankers, we have the anti-Castro Cubans, and we even have, as I point out in the book, we even have a definite connection to very deeply buried Nazi interests. So all of these are in the background.
Oh, my.
All of them. And what I try and do, George Ann, in the book is to show what the basic architecture is of this conspiracy, rather than argue this group or that group
yes.
is principally responsible for it. What I come to the conclusion in the book is that the planning committee, whoever was involved and sat in the smoke-filled room and planned this dastardly murder, that committee probably had representatives from each of the groups that had an interest in getting rid of that president.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And you can see this. For me, George Ann, the Rosetta Stone for me in uncovering the architecture of this conspiracy are the seven commissioners that Lyndon Johnson himself appoints to the Warren Commission.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you look at each of the men that he appoints, you know, Gerald Ford, Hale Boggs, Alan Dulles, John J. McCloy, Chief Justice Warren, Senator Russell, you know, if you look at each of these men carefully and look at their backgrounds, at some point, each one of these commissioners represents one or more of the major coalescing interests that other researchers have said were involved in the assassination.
Oh, my.
So, in other words, the cover-up is in place.
Yeah.
At the point that Lyndon Johnson selects those people. This was not accidental, George Ann.
Yes.
And to me, this is the clearest indicator that if Johnson was not personally involved in the planning of it, he was at least involved at a level of an accessory after the fact. Because you cannot get that kind of representation of all those interests that can be plausibly argued as having been involved in the crime. You cannot get that by accident. Those are seven Warren commissioners that are carefully selected to represent those interests and ensure that the cover story of Oswald the Lone Nut Assassin is put out there and maintained. And this is the other crucial component of the book, George Ann. That story is maintained long enough for the interests that put Johnson into power to unravel the things that Kennedy was trying to do and to maintain the status quo that they represented in power.
Oh, my God.
In other words, the cover-up had to work only so long.
Yeah.
And as long as it worked, then their interests were secure, and that's exactly what happened.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, the other thing that I have to point out, and I'm sorry that I'm taking so long to answer your question, but it's really probably the profound question that needs to be asked concerning the whole sorry affair.
Yes.
The other thing that I point out is that when you discuss the Kennedy assassination, you're really discussing three different crimes, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You're discussing the actual planning of a murder of a president.
Yes.
That's the first crime.
Right.
The second crime is you have to position the patsy or the scapegoat at the point where he will take the fall for the crime.
Yes.
All right. Now, I personally believe that it's very arguable that Oswald was involved at some secondary level in the broader conspiracy surrounding Kennedy. I mean, you know, you only have to read what I write about Oswald and his strange, strange background.
Yes.
That has intelligence handling stamped all over it.
Yes.
To get the understanding that when he himself said, "I'm just a patsy," he knew what he was talking about.
Yes.
Because he was a professional in the trade of intelligence. All right. That's not saying that I believe he was actually up there on the sixth floor accomplishing feats of marksmanship that FBI snipers could not reproduce at the behest of the Warren Commission.
Yeah.
You know, it's, oh, you know, it's just, oh. It's a ludicrous story, but we'll get to that part of it too. So that's the second aspect of the crime. You have to position the scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part of the crime is you have to institute and maintain a cover-up. So there's three levels to this architecture. And depending on the level that you're looking at, and this is something I think that other assassination researchers tend to drop the ball on a little bit, is that when they look at the assassination, they're not making an adequate distinction between these three levels, and therefore of the spheres of responsibility that each of those coalescing groups have to bear and play in it.
Yes.
And we'll get to what I mean in a moment. What I mean is, if you look at a third aspect of the conspiracy, that third level, the maintenance of the cover-up, then what you also have to look at are the so-called dead witnesses. All right.
Oh, yes.
And when you and by witness here, I'm using the term loosely because that's what other researchers call them, although some of them are not actually witnesses to the crime in any sense. They're simply people associated at some level of association with the principal players in the whole wider picture. All right.
Yeah.
But if you look at that wider picture and these so-called dead witnesses, a very, very interesting pattern, actually two patterns, emerges. The first pattern is that most of these witnesses mysteriously die right before some major government investigation of the crime itself. In other words, this happens at the greatest frequency around the time that the Warren Commission is sitting and doing its quote-unquote investigation. It happens again when the House Assassinations Committee gets underway and starts investigating, and on and on this goes. Every time a the District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation, anytime any governmental agency attempted to investigate and get to the bottom of it, you have all these dead witnesses happening.
Yes, a little suspicious.
Well, yeah. It's more than just a little suspicious. It's statistically impossible.
Yes.
That this should happen by coincidence. That's the problem.
Yeah.
There's a movie out called Executive Action with, oh golly, Burt Lancaster. How could I forget him? It was one of the very earliest kind of fictional film presentations of the idea of a conspiracy. Burt Lancaster and Robert Ryan and Will Gear and you know, all those good old character actors in this film. But at the very end of and it's an excellent film. It's kind of the JFK before JFK, all right?
Oh, dear.
And it's, if people have seen JFK and enjoyed that movie, then they should get executive action, because it is equally as provocative and thought-provoking as JFK is. The screenplay is by Dalton Trumbo, which, you know, that means it's a very, very good, engaging film.
Yeah.
But at the very end of this, the producers of the film put up a montage of pictures of all the dead witnesses.
Oh.
And they consulted both an actuary for an insurance company in London, and one can only guess that that insurance company was probably Lloyd's of London. And they also consulted a bookmaker to lay odds on all of these people dying by the various means that they died,
mm-hmm.
happening by pure coincidence. And the odds that were returned were something in the trillions to one.
Oh, my gosh. Oh. Yeah.
So, in other words, you know, we're not dealing here with a lone nut. We are dealing with a deep, vast conspiracy whose true depth and true extent are only visible if you look closely at the associations in the background of the Warren commissioners themselves. If you look closely at the background of Lyndon Johnson and his crony John Connolly down in Texas, and who they're associated with, and incidentally, how they are personally involved in the planning of that trip.
Yes.
And finally, at the pattern of the dead witnesses. Now, when you look at the pattern of the dead witnesses, I said there are two. The first being that they happen to die in clusters around the times of major government investigations. But there's another pattern, and it's equally vital, and it's one that, in my opinion, most, if not all, other assassination researchers have missed.
Mm.
And that is that in the cases where the witnesses have died by the clear hand of man,
yes,
in the case where they have been murdered,
yes,
or in cases where their deaths are unusually suspicious and convenient, if you look at those cases in that fashion, then it appears that you can assign to each group involved or represented in the assassination and the interests planning it. It appears that you can say that each group was responsible for cleaning up the loose ends within its own, so to speak, jurisdiction or sphere of interest. So in other words, the mafia people that knew things or possibly knew things about the assassination were killed by good old mafiosi hits.
Uh-huh.
they were found, you know, like in the case of Sam Giancana, found in his dead in his home, shot to death in Chicago, having been shot in the back of the head and then around his mouth after he had been shot the first time. And he was in his kitchen and had apparently been preparing a meal. So in other words, to get into his house, it had to have been someone he knew and trusted.
Yes.
And, you know, that is a typical mafia-style hit. And you find a couple of other instances where people involved or indicating knowledge of some aspect of the assassination that had mafia associations.
You said around his mouth.
Yes, that's a mafia signal to keep your lips shut. This is what happens to people that open their mouth.
What, they shot around his mouth?
His mouth, yes.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, repeatedly.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. After the kill shot, then they shot, you know, just kept shooting around his mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And, you know, his poor daughter came home and found her father, you know, shot to death in that fashion.
Oh, God.
Now, mind you, Sam Giancana was not a nice man.
Yeah.
But, you know, my point is if you look at the dead witnesses, you'll find the MO of each interest or represented group present in the actual deaths of these people. For example, there are a number of convenient and suspicious deaths by heart attack. Okay? Well, we know that intelligence agencies have the means, the capability to induce or murder people.
Yes.
And make it look like death by natural causes. If you don't know what to look for, then you're not going to detect certain toxins and so on and so forth.
Right.
So in other words, you have all of these MOs operative in the deaths of the witnesses, and that says to me, anyway, or at least one of the conclusions that I draw, is that after the crime had been committed as a component or feature of the architecture of the conspiracy, that each group was assigned the responsibility for cleaning up any loose ends within its own house and according to its own rules.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, in other words, it was business as usual.
Yeah. Oh, gee.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned two caskets and two or three ambulances.
Yes. That's in a chapter, the second chapter, which is called The Twos and the Twos, T-W-O and then T-O-O, Twos and the Twos. Because if you look at certain things in the assassination, there are either too many things or too few things. The first example being, we have at least two Oswalds, if not possibly three. Okay.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has long been a known fact to assassination researchers, because at the very minimum, while one Oswald is in the Soviet Union after his quote-unquote defection, J. Edgar Hoover writes a memo to the State Department expressing concern that someone in the United States is using Oswald's birth certificate and running around posing as Oswald. So, in other words, right there from the director's mouth. You know,
oh, my gosh.
You have the idea of two Oswalds.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I put a photograph in the book of a photographic comparison done by a man in Texas by the name of, I think it's Jim White, that compares a photo of Oswald in Russia to a photograph of Oswald when he was in the Marines, all right?
Yes.
And by aligning certain features on his face, what you discover is other features on the right side and left side of the two faces do not align.
Why
For example,
am I not surprised?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. Gosh.
And, you know, in the case of Oswald, we also have two different descriptions of his height.
Yes.
And at one point, he seems to have shrunk.
Oh, my.
by the time of the assassination. So, in other words, we are dealing, even at that level of the selected patsy, we are dealing with an obfuscated trail. And to me, that's a profound MO right there, Georgianne. And I don't discuss it at length in the book, but I'll mention it here. Because that MO, if you recall from reading the Nazi International, is exactly the method that was used, in my opinion, to get Bormann and Müller and possibly even Hitler himself out of Berlin at the end of the war and obfuscate the trail by using one or more doubles.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know,
yeah,
the trail became so hopelessly confused that you had no chance of hunting these criminals down. And the method, again, shows up in the Kennedy assassination. And that's not the only thing, by any stretch of the imagination, pointing to some sort of involvement of the post-war Nazis in the whole thing.
Oh,
so in other words, this is huge. This is huge. Now, you mentioned two ambulances. All right.
Yeah.
That part of the book is the result of one of the more well-known Kennedy assassination researchers by the name of David Lifton, who wrote a book called, Best Evidence. And in that book, he points out that, first of all, the casket that is used to take President Kennedy's body mm-hmm. from Parkland Hospital to Air Force One was a typical, you know, bronze funeral home casket for an actual funeral, like you would see during a wake, all right?
Yes.
But the casket that is taken off Air Force One by the time it lands in at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C., is what is called a shipping casket, which is a much plainer affair. And in that case, that casket also was damaged, according to the witnesses who saw it and removed it from the hearse when it arrived at Bethesda Naval Hospital. It had been damaged, whereas the casket used in Dallas had not. So at some point between Dallas and Washington, D.C., the body had been switched and the caskets had been switched.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. Now, as if that's not enough, when you examine the statements of the Dallas doctors, the doctors that were trying desperately to save the remaining shreds of life of President Kennedy in Parkland Hospital.
Yes.
These doctors describe one set of wounds where the entry wound is clearly from the front and exploding out the back of the skull.
Yes.
All right. When you get the Bethesda doctors describing the wounds, they are describing a completely different set of wounds.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, Lifton's approach here is very unique because rather than saying both one or the other set of doctors has to be lying.
Yes.
What he is assuming is both sets of doctors are telling the truth, exactly what they saw. So he concludes that at some point between Dallas and Bethesda, President Kennedy's body had been altered to disguise or cover up forensic evidence that would suggest more than one shooter and specifically any evidence of a shooter from the front.
Well, you know, when I watched this as it happened,
yes.
I was standing in the living room with my grandmother, and it looked to me as the driver turned around and shot.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are people that there are no witnesses that say that the driver shot.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing that I get into in the book very extensively, is the whole role of the Zapruder film.
Yeah.
Because again, and that occurs in that second chapter, because again, we have many versions of it out there.
Yes.
And all of those versions, with the exception of one, have been tampered with to alter or stretch certain sequences and then to completely remove others, all right? In any court of law, photographic or video film evidence is to take secondary precedence to the actual statements of eyewitnesses. And most people don't realize that. Most people don't know that. But the reason being precisely that photographs and films can be altered or faked.
Yes.
Whereas the testimony, the spontaneous testimony of eyewitnesses on the spot at the time is more likely to show accurate results when compared. Now, what the witnesses say universally is that after the first shot, the motorcade itself slowed down, and some witnesses even say that it altogether completely stopped. Mm. Now, there's a big problem right there, Georgianne.
Yes.
Because the first reaction by, pardon me, by protocol of the Secret Service in the security of protection of the president would not be to stop or slow down, but to speed up. And in fact, the whole point of that left turn onto Elm off of Main Street in Dallas was to slow the motorcade down slow enough so that accurate shots could be made, because otherwise the standard security procedure was motorcades were not to proceed at anything less than 40 miles an hour, which they would have been able to do had they continued straight on down Main Street.
Yes.
So in other words, the Secret Service here and its actions in some cases, and I go into this rather extensively in the book, in some cases is acting complicit in the crime.
Yes.
And that means that pressure had to have been put on the Secret Service from a very high level, and that could only come from within the executive branch of government.
Oh.
Are we getting the picture?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that order certainly isn't going to come from President Kennedy.
That's for sure. Oh, my gosh.
You know, so, you know, you add all this up, Georgianne. You've got, and, oh, here's another, you know, since we're on the subject of too many things.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the most curious things in the assassination, and to me it's a very significant thing, is that the Dallas sheriff's deputies that originally reached the sixth floor of the school book depository and investigated the so-called sniper's nests, all right?
Mm-hmm.
What they found there were three empty shell cartridges, of course, from the rifle that had allegedly been used to do the deed.
Yeah.
But they were neatly arranged on the floor, almost in kind of a row.
Oh.
All right? Now, when you're firing a bolt-action rifle, the cartridge is ejected and it just flies out, and
right.
You know, it lands wherever it lands.
Right.
You know, it doesn't land in a neat little pattern, you know, on the floor.
Oh.
And we'll get back to one of these cartridges in a moment, okay? Because there's also a magic cartridge that goes with the magic bullet.
Okay? Oh, boy. Oh,
okay.
Oh,
yeah, well, yeah, it just gets worse and worse. But the sheriff's deputies that got up there to the sixth floor, one of them was a fellow by the name of Roger Craig, who incidentally later, of course, turns up dead.
Oh.
Okay. But these three sheriff's deputies, to a man, all described the rifle that they discovered up there as being a 7.65 Mauser.
Oh,
okay.
German.
Yeah, German.
Yes.
Okay. Later on, the rifle has suddenly and magically switched to an Italian 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano with a misaligned telescopic sight. Okay, on top of everything else, you know, the worst bolt-action rifle ever manufactured is now the assassination weapon, and the telescopic sight is misaligned.
Well,
yeah.
Oh, gee.
And, you know, he accomplished this feat of marksmanship with that piece of junk.
Yes, oh my.
So, in other words, we've got two rifles. And it's very interesting to me just to consider the symbolic implication of a rifle from one former Axis power being replaced by a rifle from another one.
Yes.
You know, the message is clear, in my opinion. But the other thing that I do not mention in the book, and this only came to my light in doing the research after the book. You know, when I write a book, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily done researching the subject.
Right.
But what happened was I discovered that the 7.65 German Mauser is not the Mauser that German soldiers used, you know, during World War II.
Oh.
It was a special version of the Mauser that the Mauser company had licensed to be built, guess where? Argentina.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, double German Nazis.
Yes, you know. So, you know, talk about sending subtle messages.
Mm.
Talk about sending subtle messages. Now, let's get back to the magic cartridge. Okay?
Yes.
Everybody knows the magic bullet. We've all probably seen pictures of it. It's this wonderfully pristine bullet that is supposedly the bullet that accomplished the kill shot of President Kennedy, then managed to do gymnastics in midair in split nanoseconds between President Kennedy and Governor Connally, passing through Governor Connally, through his ribs, then his right wrist, and then ricocheting over and embedding itself into Governor Connally's left thigh, and then emerging in pristine condition, having passed through all that tissue and bone, onto a stretcher at Parkland Hospital in Dallas.
Mm.
Okay? Now, the thing is, you can fire the same kind of bullet through bone and tissue, and it's not going to come out in that sort of condition at all.
Yeah.
It's going to be horribly mangled and bent out of shape.
Cool.
All right? So we have a magic bullet. Well, guess what? One of the cartridges that was found was later determined to be so defective that it couldn't even have been fired in the rifle. You know, I'm thinking, this is the magic carpet, the cartridge that fired the magic bullet. You know?
Oh,
the cartridge
gosh.
That couldn't shoot a bullet that couldn't possibly have done all the things that the Warren Commission said it did.
Well, you know, I mentioned that I saw the driver turn around and shoot, and that's when Kennedy's head went back. And and right about then is when Jacqueline tried to jump out of the limo and went over onto the trunk.
Well, there was clearly a shot from the front. The idea that it was the man that was driving the limousine is a story that was put out by a fellow by the name of William Cooper. And it's at times been accompanied by purported photographs showing the incident.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that every other photograph that we have does not show this.
Well,
so,
I'm not surprised.
Well, my point is, I'm not doubting what you saw, but, you know, I am not satisfied because I don't remember seeing that personally myself. And secondly, I haven't seen enough other evidence to suggest that this was possibly the case.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know, at the minimum, that the limousine, at the point that the first shot rang out, began to slow, and some people even say came to a complete stop.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the driver of the limousine is at least complicit through negligence.
Yes. Yes. Oh, gosh, Joseph. Yikes. Well, Oswald was tried and found guilty in New Zealand before he was charged in Dallas. How did that happen?
Well, let's set that up a bit. In the movie JFK, there is a scene between Jim Garrison, who is played by Kevin Costner, and a man that he meets in Washington, D.C. that's known only as X, that's played by Donald Sutherland.
Yeah.
All right. Sutherland in the movie proceeds to tell Garrison that he, as a military man, had been ordered during the period of the assassination to escort a group of dignitaries to Antarctica.
Yeah.
And then on his way back, he stopped through Christchurch, New Zealand, where he picked up a paper that had been, you know, published as a flash extra.
Yeah.
With a complete biography of Oswald, the alleged assassin, within a matter of mere hours of the assassination. And incidentally, this was at a time of day in New Zealand that would have been before Oswald was even charged with the crime in Dallas.
Oh, yes.
So in other words, yeah, you're right. Oswald has been tried and found guilty in the New Zealand press before he's even been charged with the crime in Dallas.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. And of course, Sutherland's character says, well, you know, having been involved in intelligence operations, what I immediately concluded was that this was a carefully constructed biography that had been put together, prefabricated by intelligence sources for release at the instant of the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, it so happens that the character that Sutherland plays in the movie is actually based on a real historical character by the name of Colonel Fletcher Prouty. All right.
Yeah.
Who was a military man connected with the White House as kind of a liaison officer between the military and the CIA. And he did get dispatched by his general. And that general, incidentally, was Ed Lansdale. You know, some of your listeners are probably familiar with that name if they dig into covert operations and psychological warfare and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And that general's name is even hinted at in Oliver Stone's movie, because you see a portion of the movie where Sutherland is talking to the general and his nameplate on his desk is partially obscured. But if you look at it carefully, it clearly says Dale at the end of it. So in other words, Stone is relying very, very heavily on Fletcher Prouty at this point. But Prouty, in his books, does point out that, you know, this newspaper headline in Christchurch, New Zealand, was exactly what, you know, he read about the assassination on the way back from Antarctica. So that episode is entirely true.
Oh, my. Okay. You write about deep ritual magic. The deep magic. Oh, dear, we lost Joseph.
This dang phone, I'm sorry.
Well, okay, we're back on.
Okay.
Deep ritual magic. Mm-hmm. The alchemy of assassination.
Yes.
What is this all about, Joseph?
All right. That is probably going to be, for most people, the most controversial part of the book. And we've been kind of preparing the groundwork for this aspect of it in our session on alchemy and the magic of social engineering.
Yeah.
Briefly, the thing that I'm getting at there is if you look at certain elements of the assassination, they have a deeply ritual, occult, esoteric, symbolic nature. For example, and I don't know if I've talked about this on some of our other sessions or not. I think maybe we've talked privately about it. But Dealey Plaza itself in Dallas is named after Texas' first Masonic Grand Master.
Oh.
So in other words, just look at the assassination from this standpoint or angle alone. You have a Roman Catholic president riding into an ambush in a plaza named for the first Grand Master of the state of Texas. In other words, an old opposition is being represented symbolically.
Yes.
In that square.
Oh.
The second thing you have to look at is the famous photo of the three tramps that is taken of these men as they're being led away to the to the city jail there for questioning. And no one has ever successfully identified, really, who these men are, although one of them does look like a convicted murderer by the name of Harrelson, actually the father of the actor, Woody Harrelson. But those identifications leave a little bit to be desired, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But in any case, these three tramps are not identified. But the symbolic significance, from the esoteric point of view, of these three tramps is that they represent the three murderers of King Hiram Abiff in the Masonic ritual.
Oh.
Ubalo, Ubala, and Ubalo,
yeah,
are their names. All right, and of course, they murder the king.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you have here a ritual murder of the king. Now, what's the point? What's the purpose of surrounding the assassination? And I should mention one final thing. If you look at the overview of Dealey Plaza, of course, you've got those three streets coming together in the triple underpass. You've got, in other words, the representation of a trident.
Yes.
All right, with all the symbolic associations to Poseidon and Neptune and Atlantis and all of that. So, in other words, you have a lot of symbolism in play. So, what does, if we look at it from the ritual magic point of view, the alchemical point of view, what is being accomplished? Well, what's being accomplished in the murder of the king is an act of black magic of the transformation of the country's consciousness.
Oh, gee.
And it's achieved precisely by parading the apparent absurdity of the official explanation, which people very quickly in this country began to question, and maintaining that absurdity in the face of mounting popular opposition to it. It's as if the elite that pulled off that crime, with all of those coalescing interests,
mm-hmm,
was thumbing its nose at the American people and inducing, and the point of the exercise is therefore to induce a state of shocked helplessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-mm. Shocked helplessness.
Yeah.
Well, it was plainly a coup.
Yes.
Plainly.
Yes.
The government has deteriorated ever since.
Yes, it has, and it was a coup in all the classic senses. That's the other thing that I try and outline in that chapter, is not only do we have here a very, very unique conspiracy,
mm-hmm,
in that it does fulfill all the standard hall. I actually bought a very classic study of coups d'etat, all right,
yeah,
by a fellow by the name of Luttwak, and if you examine what he says is necessary for a successful coup, you know, he lays out the pattern, the strategy of going about how to pull all of this off.
Yeah.
And you compare it to what actually happens in the Kennedy assassination, the suspension of normal security procedures.
Yes.
The seizure of the centers or symbols of power has to be done very quickly. Well, where does Lyndon Johnson make a beeline to on the day of the assassination? But right back to the White House.
Yeah. You know?
All of the classic hallmarks of a coup d'etat are there. You have to neutralize any potential opposition. Well, where is President Kennedy's cabinet during the assassination? But on an airplane from Hawaii to Japan.
Yeah.
So in other words, the only person that really, at that point in the government, that could possibly mount some sort of questioning opposition to the whole thing is the president's own brother, Bobby Kennedy, at the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
All right? But the rest of the government is effectively, for all intents and purposes, out of the picture, except for Lyndon Johnson.
Well, he's a dirty, filthy crook.
Well,
oh. Oh.
He's not a nice character. That's certainly true.
Yeah,
he's got, in my opinion, as I've mentioned before, he has at least, I think, a prima facie case could be made that if he were alive now, he could be easily indicted by a grand jury.
Yes.
Now, that's a different thing from a trial, certainly.
Yeah.
But in terms of enough evidence to indict absolutely, at least at the minimum, as an accessory after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of a coup d'etat, it's an unusual one in two senses, because first of all, you do have this ritual magic component to the assassination.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's unusual in that the people pulling off the coup d'etat are really wanting to protect what they perceive as the status quo. In other words, they're not the revolutionaries. In their view, Kennedy is.
Yes, yes. Oh. So bottom line,
mm-hmm.
Why was he murdered?
Well, again, we have to look at the interests that coalesce.
Yes.
All right. For one thing, let's take the mafia.
Okay.
Clearly there is a mafia level of involvement in the assassination that is quite high in terms of probable actual operational planning and perhaps even provision of personnel. In other words, some of the assassination teams. All right.
Okay.
The mafia had a clear interest in two senses. The first being that Robert Kennedy's Justice Department, having been brought into power,
mm-hmm.
largely through mafia connivance in Chicago, in altering the election results there, you know, it was a very, very close election between President Kennedy and then Vice President Richard Nixon.
Yeah, there's still fooling around with the elections in Chicago.
Well yeah, you know, that nothing has changed in that county.
Right.
But the mafia was involved in some of this, and as soon as Kennedy took office, the Justice Department, under his brother, began to go after organized crime, shipping in a very undignified manner, shipping Carlos Marcello out of New Orleans and basically tossing him out of the country into Guatemala. You know?
Yeah.
And then secondly, the Kennedy response to Cuba by not going full force behind the Bay of Pigs invasion, well, you know, the mafia lost a lot of revenue from their casinos
yes.
in Cuba. So
yes.
they had clear and vested, vital financial interests and personal interests in taking out the Kennedy administration because it was going after them, and it was not, in their eyes, protecting their business interests in Cuba. All right? So they've got a motivation to be involved, and they've got the means to be involved. The only thing the mafia does not have the means to do, at least at that time, in my opinion, is to do all of the running of someone like Oswald and put him in all the right places at the right times, including the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
This is clearly beyond mafia capability. And to run a, you know, now what is it, 57 years, I think that's right, you know, decades-long cover-up, that also, I think, is beyond the ability of the mafia to do on its own. So they may have had the means and the motive, but they didn't have the means and motive, or pardon me, the means to perpetuate the third level of the cover-up all by themselves. So there had to be other interests. So let's look at some of the other interests.
Okay.
Let's look at the CIA, the intelligence community. Well, after the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy signed an executive memorandum, and his own words were that he was going to smash, you know, this is cited in Oliver Stone's movie, that he was going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces and that it was no longer going to be conducting all these covert paramilitary black operations.
Yeah. Right?
Well, the CIA, which at that point under Alan Dulles had become a virtual fiefdom unto itself.
Yes.
Has clearly a threatened interest of bureaucratic power in that executive action memorandum.
It's still a fiefdom, although.
It's still a fiefdom,
yeah.
Yes. You know, Kennedy was going to change that. But in threatening the CIA, Kennedy's threatening somebody else.
Yes.
and let's remember who they are. Uh-huh. Let's go back to that dirty deal that Alan Dulles made toward the close of World War II with the Nazi general, Reinhard Galland, to take over lock, stock, and barrel Galland's entire military intelligence group in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And leave it, according to the bargain that they struck, and leave the day-to-day operational oversight of that network right in Galen's hands.
Oh, dear.
So the CIA, in other words, as one writer put it, was nothing at that time other than a front for a house of Nazi spies.
Yeah.
So when Kennedy is taking aim at the CIA, he's also taking aim at one of the institutions of Nazi power into which they had burrowed themselves, courtesy of Alan Dulles, who, incidentally, let's remember, was later appointed by Lyndon Johnson to be one of the Warren Commissioners.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So in other words, Dulles is there protecting that group of interests of the American intelligence community, and he's protecting the interests of this Nazi International, or Hydra, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
that had been put into place by the Nazis prior to the end of the war.
Uh-oh.
You know, this it just gets worse and worse. Let's look at the major oil companies. Let's look at the big Texas oilmen. Kennedy had gone after the oil depletion allowance and wanted to cut it back.
Yeah.
And under his proposals, that meant that the big oilmen stood to lose about $300 million in profits a year.
Mm.
So they had a reason to be involved, and as I point out in the book, there's even a connection between the Texas oilmen, and particularly H.L. Hunt, and guess what? West German intelligence, which is what? Galen's organization.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you see?
It gets stickier.
Yes, it does.
Oh.
It does. It's truly amazing once you start prying open all these connections.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in taking aim at one group, Kennedy is really taking aim at them all.
Yeah.
Let's look at the bankers. Kennedy, in June of 1963, had signed Executive Order 11,110, I think was the number. And in the executive order, he authorized the U.S. Treasury to issue $4 billion plus a few odd hundred million dollars in change in United States notes, all right?
Yeah.
Now, this was truly, I can't tell you what a step that was.
Oh, yeah.
What great big brass ones it took to do that.
Oh, yeah.
pardon my colloquialism there, but there's no other way to put it. Because in doing this, Georgianne, what he was effectively doing was said, we are going to circulate $4 billion of currency debt-free.
Yes.
So in other words, the bankers that represented the power of the Federal Reserve and its assumed monopoly over the issuance of the nation's currency as monetized debt was directly threatened.
Good.
So they've got a motivation.
Yeah.
You see, and on we could go. Almost everyone that has been named in any assassination literature had at some point come under the crosshairs of the Kennedy administration.
Wow.
So virtually everybody had a powerful and pressing motive, and many of them had the means to be involved in the planning and commission of the crime itself. The key to the deepest players has always remained the long-term cover-up. And there are only a very few interests that are represented on those Warren commissioners that had the means and ability and handle on the government and its agencies to perpetuate a cover-up of something that extensive.
Wow. Well, nobody has been prosecuted,
right,
for this criminal act.
Well, that's not strictly true. Jim Garrison did prosecute Clay Shaw.
Yeah, well, Clay Shaw conveniently died.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You make a brief mention of NASA.
Yes.
How does that figure into all this?
That's the most interesting, to me, part of the whole story. It's actually a part of the story that was first uncovered by my friend Richard Hoagland. And it was first suggested in a little-known document called the Torbit document that was circulated kind of samizdat style. It was a typewritten manuscript privately circulated by a Texas attorney that had been at one point a member of Johnson's machine in Texas, but after the assassination became so disgusted with it that he severed all connections with it.
Yeah.
And basically summarized what he knew and summarized what had been uncovered by Garrison's team of investigators in New Orleans. And he mentioned that one of the major players in the assassination was none other than Dr. Wernher von Braun, representing the interests of NASA. Now, why would you have that constellation of interests? Why would you have a quote unquote former Nazi and NASA interests as possibly being some of the threatened interests of that were represented in the assassination?
Oh.
Well, the answer is that all throughout his administration, after he made the announcement that America was going to place a man on the moon before the close of the decade, after making that announcement, Georgeann, President Kennedy saw space and space exploration as a possible means of collaboration and cooperation with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, and as a means of easing the tensions between the two countries. And it really got into high gear after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when, you know, we came within minutes of incinerating each other.
Yeah.
And he persisted, even though Khrushchev at the time initially rebuffed and turned down these proposals by President Kennedy. Kennedy then went on in, I think it was 1963, in a speech to the General Assembly of the United Nations to make the same offer to Khrushchev publicly. All right?
Oh.
Now, Mr. Hoagland uncovered the fact that Nikita Khrushchev's son, Sergei, maintained that his father and he discussed this offer in 1963 in Moscow at Khrushchev's dacha outside the city.
Yeah.
And that his father told him that he had finally decided that he was going to accept President Kennedy's offer. And of course, that was in early November 1963. And a couple of weeks later, of course, President Kennedy is dead. And I think less than a year after that, if my memory serves me correctly, Premier Khrushchev was outed, you know, kicked out of office.
Yes.
In the Soviet Union by a combination of Leonid Brezhnev and Alexei Kosygin. Now, why would NASA be involved? Well, let's look at the Nazi angle here. You have all of these Nazi scientists that are basically the brain trust behind America's missile program and America's space program.
Yes.
And in Mr. Hoagland's opinion, and I think it's an argument that needs to be examined and weighed very carefully, because it's the argument that makes the most sense to me. In Mr. Hoagland's opinion, the reason that this was perceived as a threat by some within NASA, including the Nazis, was that the real purpose of going to the moon was because they had already figured out somehow that there may be technology up there from some other era that was somebody else's.
Yes.
And the last people that you wanted to share that technology with, especially if you're a Nazi or a hardline Cold Warrior in the American Space Agency,
yeah,
are the communists.
Yes.
And there's another aspect of this story that I want to add that I think may be playing in here, because repeatedly I have suggested in my books, especially in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that the Nazis had, by the time of the moon landings, gained such influence over the actual mission planning and scheduling of these events that, you know, we had Apollo 11, the first manned lunar landing on the 25th anniversary of the failed bomb plot against Adolf Hitler. Now, you know, that should tell you something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other moon missions landing on his birthday, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you don't plan space missions to land at certain places at certain times by accident. That's just, you know, it's just
right.
Not the nature of the beast.
Right.
But I believe that, and I've outlined kind of a, a very brief case, that there may have been alternative technology that got us to the moon, and more importantly, off of it once we got onto it.
Yeah.
Okay? And that this technology may be the reason why you see people like Dr. Kurt Davis in the positions of administrative power within NASA that you do. Because Davis was, of course, one of the scientists involved with the Nazi Bell.
Oh.
And what's he doing for NASA? Why? He is the senior flight administrator during the Apollo programs at Cape Canaveral.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's not even a rocket scientist.
Oh.
So, in other words, if they're sharing some of that technology with us to make the moon landings possible,
mm-hmm.
That's a mighty big if. Please understand that.
Yeah.
But if they are, then again, Kennedy, by saying, let's go to the moon with the Russians, is implicitly saying, let's share any of our good secrets with them, too.
Ah.
And again, the last people you want to be sharing any technology that you have or that you may recover on the moon are the communists.
Yes.
So again, I think you have a plausible case that there are circles of power within NASA, including the Nazis, but certainly not exclusively limited to them, who would have seen Kennedy's moves to make some sort of joint collaborative space effort a threat to the national security.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it seems that there are artifacts up there.
Sure.
And I forget who it was that said, we have the technology to go to the moon and back for lunch.
Oh, boy. Georgianne, that is such a can of worms. In fact, I'm actually, you know that I've been doing this major website overhaul in
yeah.
kind of a desperate attempt to diversify my income stream. And,
yes.
Because it's getting very difficult to project long-term survival if I don't.
Yes.
But one of the things I'm going to be having eventually on the site is a members-only area.
Yes.
And one of the papers I've been working on to make available at a low cost in that area is precisely a paper on these types of statements that have been made from time to time by people that have been involved in the American military-industrial complex, and more importantly, by people that have had a clear and undeniable association with black projects.
Yes.
Concerning aerospace and advanced aircraft and space systems and so on and so forth. When you look at some of these statements, that one that you just cited pales and I do emphasize the word, pales into insignificance from some of the things that they have actually been quoted on record as saying.
Oh, my gosh, Joseph. Oh.
Yeah, and I don't want to let out any of the details of that, because there's one statement in particular that one of these men made that, in my opinion, has never been adequately analyzed. But again, Kennedy, you know, if you look at the track record of President Kennedy, whether or not you agreed with the man's politics or even his personal life, there can be no doubt that as a man, he was a man of vision and certainly wasn't a coward.
That's true.
He managed in the short time of his presidency to, and I'm going to be very blunt in the way I put it, he managed in the short time of his administration to piss off just about every vested interest in the hidden and deep parapolitical structures that he could in this country.
Yes, yes he did. No doubt about it, Joseph, and it's unfortunate that it
yes.
caused him his life.
Yes, it is. It is. But, you know, again, we have to be careful even in saying that, because he did not kill himself.
Right.
You know, there are criminals that planned a deliberate, brutal, bloody act of murder.
Yes.
Of a man. And it clearly was a politically motivated murder, but it was also a murder of the American psyche.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I, like you and many others, are sufficiently old enough to remember
yes.
the event. And we are sufficiently old enough to remember the deep spiritual damage that it has done to this country in the time since.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, Georgianne, we've had since President Kennedy a virtual succession of sock puppets for
yeah,
presidents.
Exactly.
You know, the last one with any sort of real chutzpah was Richard Nixon, you know, and like him or not, or despise the man's politics or not, again, you were dealing with someone that had some sort of conviction to him. But since then, it's just been, you know, one parade of mediocrity after another.
Exactly.
And we have seen an increase since Kennedy's assassination of government by corruption and conspiracy. We've had, since that time, we've had Iran-Contra, we've had Watergate, we've had Ruby Ridge, we've had Waco, we've had, you know, Oklahoma City, we've had the savings and loan fiasco, we've had the BCCI banking scandal, you know, on and on it has gone in this increasing parade of corruption and greed and malfeasance.
Yes.
And I think to put President Kennedy into perspective, we have to go back to the statement that his predecessor made when he left office. And again, I remember President Eisenhower. I was four years old when he made that military-industrial complex speech.
Yes.
On television in the evening, you know, and I remember it vividly because, you know, even though I didn't understand a word he was saying, I remember it because he was interrupting my favorite TV program. And my parents were in the kitchen playing cards with their friends, and I was out in the living room watching television, and all of a sudden there's this old guy in glasses, you know, blathering
yeah.
on and on and on, you know. But I remember this speech, and I think that President Eisenhower, and I get into this speech in many of my books, because I think he was talking as openly as he dared about what he perceived to be the nature of the parapolitical beast
yeah.
that was confronting the country, this huge, enormous military, industrial, intelligence complex.
Yes.
And we must remember that this man was at the end of his military career, a five-star general. And he was also the senior commander of the forces of the Western Allies in Europe in World War II. So that when he's talking about a military-industrial complex, he's also very subtly talking about something that he fought.
Yes.
That was based in Nazi Germany. So I've always held the conviction that he was not only talking about our American homegrown military-industrial complex, but that he was talking about something much, much deeper and making vague allusions to the fact that this fascist element had penetrated American institutions, agencies of government, corporations, with a philosophy that was completely antithetical to the Republic. And I think President Kennedy, when he took office, if he didn't realize it before taking office, he realized what Eisenhower was saying very quickly after he was in power.
Yes, yes.
And the reason I say that is, again, look at President Kennedy's actions. Whether you agree with the man's politics or not, look at his actions, because each of them are taking direct aim at one of the institutions of the power that Eisenhower was talking about.
Yes, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Oh my gosh, Joseph, this book that you've written, LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, A Coalescence of Interests, it's fantastic. It goes through everything. I can't think of anything you haven't touched on in here. And it is an exquisite book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we're just sort of scratching the surface.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we'll be talking more about it. But yeah, we're just this is such a vast, vast monster, George.
Yeah.
It's got so many heads and so many cells and so many implications that, you know, it would take volumes, really, to discuss them all adequately.
Yeah. Mm. Wow. Well, I thank you.
Well, thank you.
Very much for contributing this to the archives of the Byte Show. And God bless you, Joseph.
Well, thank you. You too.
Thank you. This has been an exciting interview. And I hope everybody will go to your website, GizaDeathStar.com, and get a copy of this book. All of Joseph Farrell's books can be purchased through his website, and he requests that you do that. That way he can keep track of how many books he sells. Whereas the other way, it's maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, that's the best way of putting it.
Yeah. So we'll get back with our social engineering, the magic of social engineering, as soon as possible. Joseph, people like those.
Well, that's good. They're important topics. And
yeah.
I do have some news on that score to share with you after we're off the air.
Okay. Can I ask you,
uh-huh,
before we go, I know people are itching to ask you, what is your opinion of what's going on in Egypt?
Well, oh boy, I'm glad you asked that question, because I just did a little one of my fireside chat videos that's up on YouTube, and it's also on my Facebook page, about Egypt, and I'm following that up on Monday with a blog on my website, a little bit more information.
Yeah.
But basically, I think we have to be extremely cautious and prudent in our analysis of what may be going on there. Because I think I said a little bit about it in the social engineering part 7 that we just did, mm-hmm. that in one sense, you cannot take a culture as old, nor a people with a long legacy of literacy, both from ancient Egypt and then in turn from Islam, that have had this long history of literacy and of culture.
Yes.
And expect them to live forever under what, for all intents and purposes, is a military dictatorship.
Yeah.
That was ushered into power. Let's remember what Gamal Abdel Nasser, who set up this regime that subsequently Anwar Sadat and now Hosni Mubarak succeeded to, and
yeah.
that was essentially that Nasser was put into power through the connivance of the CIA, once again working through that West German intelligence cutout,
yeah.
sending him a bunch of Nazis to train their intelligence service and their army. And, you know,
oh dear.
you can't take a regime like that and expect people to live under it for that length of time and not have pressure and the normal human aspiration for freedom not boil over.
Well, millions and
yeah.
millions of those people live on less than $2 a day.
Yes.
They can't
yes.
even buy food.
Yes.
And on Al Jazeera the other night, they were interviewing a young man, and he said, yeah, they send us hormones for our crops and
yeah.
Grain that's for cattle, and our government expects us to eat it.
Eat it, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, precisely. You can't take people and expect them to live under such conditions. You know, you're seeing, so in other words, my point is, at one level, at the most visible and obvious level,
yeah.
you're seeing the natural human response.
Yes.
All right? But I think if you look deeper, I think there is now a growing body of thought and evidence that would suggest that the Western elites that have been sustaining
yeah.
this regime in Egypt are now perhaps working to remove it and replace it with something more to the liking of the people. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is behind the rioting activity,
mm-hmm.
there are probably going to be found agents provocateurs of the Western intelligence agencies, largely of the United States and the United Kingdom, but probably also France as well. Certainly, I think you're going to find some Israeli involvement, and certainly I think you're going to find some Russian involvement in trying to manipulate the situation.
Oh, yes.
To put into power a new government that is more moderate in its policies domestically, and that will be acceptable to the Egyptian people, but also to the elites. Now, in this situation, I think you have to admit the possibility that there are also other hidden hands in the form of radicalized elements of Islam.
Yeah.
And they will be pressing for a very different form of government.
Well, Islam and democracy are totally at odds with each other. They don't go together.
Yeah, no, they don't. And, you know, unfortunately, this is something that has been pointed out many times by Islamic scholars themselves, is
yes.
that Islam has had no equivalent of, you know, a Protestant Reformation or a Catholic Counter-Reformation. In other
yeah.
words, you're dealing with a religion that for all intents and purposes is not only medieval, but it's really Old Testament in a certain sense.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been conducive to this in the past, and those more or less modern nation states or governments that exist in that part of the world where Islam is the predominant culture. Those governments are sustained largely by the power and propping up support of the West and its corporations. So you're looking at a very delicate situation, and it could go many different ways. Now, there's a third thing I want to mention, and that is that in this whole process of rioting and loot and looting, it's very interesting to me, Georgianne, that the Museum of Antiquities in Memphis in Egypt and the Egyptian National Museum itself were looted. And once again, just as in the Baghdad looting, museum looting, you had in the case of the looting of the museum in Cairo, the involvement of the very security personnel in the museum itself. In other words, you're looking once again at an inside job. Now, it's too early to say whether or not this has any hallmarks other than that of suspicion. But I find it very interesting, Georgianne, that I think only a couple days ago, President Mubarak appointed Zahi Hawass, who is, you know, the antiquities czar for Egypt. You know, he exercises an iron control over all of the ancient sites in Egypt. Well, he appointed Zahi Hawass to a cabinet-level position. Now, to me, Georgianne, this means, you know, people that have dug into Hawass's background have pointed out over and over again that this man is basically a front man for the Western elites and academies. All right? For Mubarak to appoint him to a cabinet-level position, I think is an indicator that Mubarak was pressured to do so in this situation. In other words, someone is wanting to make darn sure that control over those sites is maintained.
It makes it makes a lot of sense.
So there is, to my mind, there is something extremely fishy about the simultaneous looting of antiquities in Memphis and Cairo, and then mere days later, you have this move by Mubarak, you know, who is a man whose regime is quickly coming to an end. Appointing as one of his last cabinet level appointments, of all people, to the cabinet level, Zahi Hawass.
My goodness. And what is your opinion of El Baradei?
Well, right now I don't have any, because, like I say, this situation is very fluid. And
he was in on the rendition flights. He's, I think, a Western elite preference.
Well, possibly so. Possibly so. You know, it all remains to be seen what's going to happen. For me, the big story is as much the museum lootings and Hawass's appointment as it is the actual rioting. Because that, to me, is a signal that there is, you know, I've maintained all along that the invasion of Iraq by the United States and Great Britain had certainly as one of its goals the projection of Anglo-American military power into that region on a permanent basis. And it had as another immediate goal, obviously, the removal of the Hussein regime in Iraq. So, you know, it had an obvious humanitarian goal. It had an economic goal in trying to secure petroleum oil fields for the West. But I have suspected all along that there was a hidden agenda, and it concerned antiquities. And the possession of sites. And the case in point being the Baghdad Museum looting. Because, again, you had the case of an inside job. That was clearly the conclusion of anybody that has studied what happened. And I strongly suspect that, in spite of the recovery of a lot of the artworks, I suspect that we are not being told, first of all, everything that was stolen, which I strongly suspect included a lot of tablets, or at least photographs or records.